I have a couple of very quick announcements before we get started. At the request of the Virginia Festival of the Book, which is being held, as all of you know, next week in Charlottesville, we have moved a forum that was originally scheduled for Wednesday of next week to Thursday of next week. So what you see in your monthly program has been changed. And instead of being Wednesday, it will be Thursday at 10 a.m. There are two books being presented. Dwight Young wrote a book called Dear Mr. President, and John Waterson, The Games Presidents Play, Sports, and the President. So that will be Thursday rather than Wednesday of next week. Second, I'd like to call everybody's attention to the annual CIAG, which is an acronym for Critical Incident Analysis Group conference that will begin here on Sunday, April 1st, from 3 to 5 o'clock p.m. in the afternoon, on a Sunday afternoon. Sorry about Sunday afternoon, but it was the only time. It's a three-day conference, and this was the only time we could work it. As was the case last year, Margaret Warner, senior correspondent for the NewsHour, will conduct a roundtable discussion with 10 people in this room. The topic is homegrown radicals and the limits of terrorism. And it's about three particular cases of radicals who grew up not in the shadow of Al-Qaeda and were radicalized and have done very bad things. So I think that'll be of some interest. Philip Mudd, who is the assistant director of the FBI in charge of counterterrorism, domestic counterterrorism, will be one of the participants, and he is going to stay after the conference and is going to give a forum on Tuesday, April 2nd, at April 3rd at 5:30 in the afternoon. So it's a great opportunity to really immerse yourself in the problems of homegrown radicals and the havoc that they are causing. Our guest today is Mark Bowden, who is an Atlantic Monthly national correspondent. He is an author, a journalist, a screenwriter, a documentary film producer, and an occasional commentator for NPR. There's really no medium for which he has not worked and worked with great distinction. Mark Bowden was educated at Loyola College of Maryland. He was a reporter and columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer for 20 years. His book, Black Hawk Down, A Story of Modern War, spent more than a year on the New York Times bestseller list and was in fact a finalist for the National Book Award and then was made into a wonderful movie. He is the author of several other books, Killing Pablo, and here's the Black Hawk Down book, and then most recently, Guests of the Ayatollah, The First Battle in America's War with Militant Islam. All of those will be available after the forum in the room outside. He is the author of four additional books, and his most recent article in Atlantic Monthly, Jihadists in Paradise, we've put copies of that all around for you to read, was recently sold to Disney and Jerry Bruckheimer, one of the premier producers of top flight action movies. And so after having read it, I'm sure all of us will want to see it on the big screen. It's a great pleasure. Mark's cousin is a football coach for Florida State who has bedeviled us for many years. But we will forgive his relationship with cousin Bobby and welcome Mark Bowden.
I think Bobby would approve of my coming down here and saluting the Seminoles in front of all of you. I'm very flattered to be asked to talk to you, and I'm here actually because I'm a fan of William Miller, who's a member of your community here, the author of a number of books, a trilogy that I read and particularly admired, and so much so that I wrote him a fan letter and got myself invited to come down and talk here at the University of Virginia. I am someone who has basically made a living writing true stories, and one of the great hazards I've found of telling nonfiction stories is that you are often mistaken for an expert on things that you really know very little about. Generally speaking, when I write a story about something, it's often the first time that I've ever visited the subject matter, and generally speaking, everything that I know about what it is I'm writing about is there in the story. So, people, for instance, when they read Black Hawk Down, I'm very flattered, but I'm frequently mistaken for a former military. They think I'm former military, or that I'm steeped in military history, and all of which is incorrect, which created some problems for me when I was touring to promote the book, Black Hawk Down. I went to a lot of military bases, and I remember distinctly being at the Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, which is a school where, as I understand it, colonels go on their path to become generals. And this colonel in the back of the room raised his hand and asked me if I thought that there should have been Bradley armored vehicles as part of the force protection package in Somalia. And I told him that I thought that before anyone was entitled to have an opinion about a Bradley armored vehicle, that he would have to at least know what one looked like. So I ducked that question. When I'm promoting articles like this piece in The Atlantic or books, I'm invited to be on television, to the endless 24/7 cable talk fest. And I'm on these shows, and sometimes I'll learn only later that they've put a legend on the screen that says, Mark Bowden, terrorism expert, or something like that. And I don't know who is a terrorism expert. Maybe Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but certainly not me. I was once on a program that they taped, and so I was at home when it aired. It was on, I guess, Meet the Press or something, and my youngest son, Benjamin, was about 16 at that time. He walked into the living room, and he saw his dad on television. So he sat down to watch, and they were asking me questions about Iraq and Afghanistan and everything. I was doing my best manfully to answer these questions. And at the end of it, he looks at me and he says, "Dad, why are they asking you?" I always try to keep that foremost in my mind when I'm wearing my expert hat. What I do is I tell stories, and I tend to tell stories about historical events, often recent, that I'm particularly interested in, and I try and tell these stories in an engaging and lively fashion through the eyes of many of the participants. And the idea is to bring, this recent history to life, and also to arrive personally at some deeper understanding of how and why things happen in the world the way they do. And I generally start working on a story like the Battle of Mogadishu, or like, in the case of Guests of the Ayatollah, the Iran hostage crisis, with only scant knowledge of what happened. And I'll spend 3, 4, 5 years interviewing and traveling and researching until I get to the point where I feel that I at least have some understanding of how and why and what happened. And at that point, I write a book. And I'm first to admit that, the stories that I tell are my understanding of what happened. And, and I'm certainly not infallible. And I'm fascinated by people, for instance, who read my stories and who have a completely different take on events, which is, of course, every bit as valid as my own. Guests of the Ayatollah is, of course, the story of the Iran hostage crisis, which I think is an event that was huge when it happened, but then rapidly sort of receded from popular memory. I think it was seen, particularly in the years immediately after it happened, as a kind of a bizarre episode unrelated to almost anything before or after. It took place, of course, during the Cold War. So the primary focus of our military and foreign policy was on containing communism still. This is back in 1979. The Soviets had invaded Afghanistan, so the United States was involved in funding the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Russians. And so I think, you know, this Islamist revolution in Iran was seen as a kind of a peculiarity of the region. And we never, I don't think, dwelt on it all that much. In light of what's happened, though, in the last 5 or 6 years, I think, to my way of thinking, this event has gained a tremendous significance because it was really our first encounter as a country with this phenomenon of militant Islam. And in that sense was, I think, a really a pivotal moment in modern history. It was certainly the first time that Americans heard themselves referred to as the Great Satan, or that we had to deal with this worldview of an Islamist culture that sees us as the devil incarnate, basically. This is a worldview that we've all become sadly very familiar with, but I think that it was first surfaced in 1979, and as we're seeing more and more in our involvement in Iraq, all things in the Middle East eventually brush shoulders, at least, with Iran, and that we have to deal with Iran and understand Iran. And I think for Americans, this is as good a starting place in modern history as any. I think the event, the takeover of the American embassy, grew out of gross misunderstandings on the part of Iran, certainly on the part of the United States as well. It was, in some senses, the grievance of Iran toward the United States was legitimate. In other senses, it wasn't at all. But basically, you know, a thumbnail sketch of America's involvement with Iran would begin in modern times with the overthrow of Mohammad Mossadegh in 1953, an elected leader of Iran, engineered by the CIA, by Kermit Roosevelt, a famous American family. And the Shah was basically put on the throne in 1953 and reigned for a quarter of a decade. And, you know, most Americans in 1979, frankly, were unaware of that involvement of the United States in Iran. But that loomed very large in the popular memory in Iran. That was a long-standing and legitimate grievance against the United States. So in 1978, 1979, when the Iranian Revolution occurred, and the Shah fled, they were set about to create this sort of utopian society, this new perfect Islamist country. And in the middle of their capital city was this big American embassy behind high brick walls and cast iron gates. And so it was perfectly natural for the Iranian revolutionaries to believe that they had succeeded in chasing the Shah out of their country, but that the United States of America, who had engineered the Shah's reign and who had backed him for 25 years, was not going to let this happen. That they were going to, at some point, the United States was going to pull the plug on their revolution. And fueling those suspicions was this big embassy compound, which was fully manned by American diplomats and military people who were coming and going at all hours, because people were throwing things at the embassy, and it had been overrun briefly in February of 1979. They had erected barriers and sand bags by all the windows and bars, and so it looked like a bunker, basically. And so I think it's perfectly understandable that the Iranians viewed the activities, the secret activities behind the walls of this embassy, as a plot, as an ongoing plot to destroy everything that they were trying to accomplish in their revolution. So that those suspicions, which as a matter of fact were untrue, nevertheless were the impetus for the seizure of the American embassy. There were 52 American diplomats and military people who were held hostage for a year and a month, 444 days. And it was, I think, one of the major episodes of modern history. I remember I started working at the Philadelphia Inquirer on November 4th, 1979, coincidentally, which was the day that the embassy was taken. And as a new reporter on the staff, they sent me up to North Philadelphia to do a little local story. But this was the big story of our times, and I think maybe this book 25 years later is my revenge on my editors for making me do something else. It was, this book, Guess the Ayatollah, the most complex writing project that I've ever undertaken. Black Hawk Down and, to a certain extent, the book Killing Pablo involved interviewing hundreds of people, so I'm used to that piece of doing this kind of work and pulling together the stories of all these different people. But in the case of the hunt for Pablo Escobar or the Battle of Mogadishu, these were events that were no more really than a blip in the news cycle in the United States. The Battle of Mogadishu was a big story for about a week. And then there was an attempted revolution in Moscow, and the eye of the world's media shifted, and we didn't hear anything more about Somalia or Mogadishu. And the hunt for Pablo Escobar, who when he was killed was ranked the seventh richest man in the world by Forbes magazine, was astonishingly underreported in this country. To me, it was just an example of how we as Americans have blinders on when it comes to the rest of the world. Bogota is about a two-hour flight from Miami. It's closer than LA, and yet it's as far away from American consciousness as Mars. And this is, you know, if you can imagine a billionaire in the United States hunted down and shot dead on a rooftop, what a huge story that would be. There would be TV docudramas and 24-hour news conversations about it going on for years. And here I was the only reporter, not just from the United States, but Colombia, for goodness sake, you know, writing a book about the hunt for Pablo Escobar. So in both of those instances, I kind of had the turf to myself working on the stories, much to my amazement, but nevertheless true. The story of the Iran hostage crisis obviously is not like that. This was the biggest news story in the world for more than a year. And when I asked my research assistant to pull together just from two or three major newspapers the newspaper coverage of this event, he brought me five gigantic boxes of clippings, which he thankfully had organized by month, all through that period. There were some 30 books that have been written about the Iran hostage crisis, but they were all books about little pieces of the story. There were books that were written by hostages about their personal ordeals. There were one or two books written by commanders of the failed rescue mission. There were members of the Carter administration who wrote books about their experiences in the White House and trying to deal with this issue. But much to my delight and surprise, frankly, no journalist or popular historian had gone back and written a book about this whole episode. So my biggest challenge initially in undertaking this project was just to digest everything that was already out there, which took a lot of time, but I felt that in order to write something worthwhile, I had to at least know what had already been done and what was already known about it. And at that point, I went out and began doing my own reporting, finding the former hostages and interviewing them, tracking down the soldiers who took part in the rescue mission, and of course traveling to Iran to find the Iranians, now middle-aged, who were involved in the takeover of the embassy. A project of this kind, any sort of writing project that you undertake, you have to find a way to conceptualize it. And I began thinking of this story fairly early on as like a three-layer cake. Because it was, in essence, three stories, any one of which would have been a book in and of itself. The first of those three stories is the story of Jimmy Carter and the Carter White House. Essentially, you have a president who's chances for a second term went down the tubes because of the Iran hostage crisis. This was an event that basically destroyed the Carter presidency. So trying to understand him, trying to understand why he did what he did, why he didn't do other things that he might have done, learning about the strenuous efforts at back-channel diplomacy that he tried for months on end with no success, and ultimately, you know, making the decision to launch this rescue mission, and finally wrestling with this in his final hours of his presidency to bring it to some kind of a conclusion before Ronald Reagan took office. That alone is kind of an epic story of the American presidency. And so that was one piece of the cake. The second layer was this rescue mission, which is just certainly one of the most fascinating and audacious military efforts ever undertaken in this country. And it ended in failure, but it was extraordinary, just extraordinary. I call it in the book a sort of Rube Goldberg contraption of a mission, which was pieced together with all these different parts of the military. We at the time lacked the capability of conducting this kind of long-range counterterrorism operation. We had just created the unit Delta Force. This was their first mission. We didn't have helicopters that could be stored on aircraft carriers on below decks in order to protect the secrecy of the mission that could be refueled in flight. So you have Marine helicopter pilots flying Navy Sea Stallion helicopters that are basically used for minesweeping operations, carrying Army commandos into Tehran. It was an extremely difficult mission, and those who criticize Carter for not acting more aggressively immediately when the embassy was taken, I think failed to understand the limitations of what he had to deal with. He went, for instance, to his military advisors when the embassy was taken, and his biggest fear, Carter said, was that the Iranians would begin executing the American captives one at a time. So he asked his military advisors, what can I do? What can we do if that starts to happen? And I interviewed for this book a wonderful fellow named Bucky Burris, who at the time was the deputy commander, Charlie Beckwith's deputy for Delta Force. And he was called on to give a briefing at the Pentagon the day after the embassy was taken, addressing what it is they would do if they were ordered to try to rescue the hostages that day. And the mission, as he briefed it, which began with the words, obviously, we don't want to do this, consisted of parachuting Delta Force operators outside of the city of Tehran, having them hijack trucks off of the road, drive the trucks into the city, raid the embassy compound, rescue the hostages, put them on trucks, and fight their way 500 miles to the border of Turkey. It was just ludicrous, and obviously no one was going to order them to do that unless it was there was no alternative. And at the time, you know, initially with the takeover of the embassy, the White House wasn't even sure who had done it. So they didn't even know how long it would last, you know, whether the provisional government in Iran would step in as they had in a previous event like this and save the day. So Carter had few options, at least initially. It took Delta Force about 5 or 6 months to cobble together this effort to rescue them. And in order to deal with the problems of getting helicopters into Tehran to pull the hostages out of the city, they had to come up with this plan to land them in the desert outside of Tehran, to land fixed-wing aircraft carrying fuel bladders in the back to refuel the helicopters, then load the helicopters up with Delta Force operators who would be flown to a hide site that morning before sunrise, hide the helicopters and the force for an entire day, and then load them on trucks in the middle of the night, drive them into the city, raid the compound, rescue the hostages, blow a hole in the wall of the embassy compound, take them across the street to a soccer stadium, strong point the soccer stadium, and then fly helicopters into the stadium, load them up with the hostages and the operators, and then, I'm just getting started. Then they were going to fly them out to an airport on the outskirts of the city, which would simultaneously be seized by a brigade of Rangers, fly in fixed-wing aircraft to the seized airport, load everybody on the aircraft, and then fly them all out of the country. That was the mission that Jimmy Carter authorized. The men who trained this mission and practiced it were very brave, first of all, but were also, they're very practical men. And for the most part, they maybe gave this a 20% chance of success. The fact that they were willing to go and do it shows the kind of people that they are. But it was interesting talking to them about it because they were so convinced that this whole thing was going to fall apart at some point that they had done things like prepare for how to get out of Iran, you know, once this thing fell apart. So they had done things like learn how to hotwire vehicles, memorize routes out of the city so they could drive to the mountains or to the Turkish border. Some of them even went so far as to memorize where there were jewelry stores along the routes out the city so they could grab jewels and gold to bribe their way, you know, help bribe their way out of the country. It was, as it turns out, you know, one of the more spectacular failures in American military history, but the failed rescue mission to Iran was the impetus for the creation of the Special Operations Force that the United States has today. And if an embassy were seized anywhere in the world, I feel certain that the president would have more options at his disposal than Jimmy Carter had in 1979. And certainly the one of the good consequences of that failure is that it woke the United States up to the need to develop this kind of flexible capability. So that's the second layer of this story. And you can see that story alone is warrants, I think, a book. I was very fortunate because I was undertaking this story 25 years later that the men who took part in this mission could talk about it for the first time. The Army gave them permission to be interviewed. So dozens of the men who were on those planes, who were in the desert when things broke down, sat down and told their stories for this book for the first time. And I do think it's an amazing chapter in American military history. The third layer of the cake, and the one that actually interested me the most, was the story of the hostages and the hostage takers. We look back on this episode knowing that the hostages were ultimately returned home safely. And so that colors, I think, our perception of what happened. In fact, this was a terrifying ordeal for the Americans involved. They had no idea that they were ever going to come home safely at the end of it. They were interrogated at great length. Many of them were beaten, badly mistreated. They were threatened continually with execution, being put on trial as spies and being executed in an environment where execution was a daily televised occurrence. This was during in the height of the revolutionary fervor in Iran, and you know, remnants of the Shah's regime and political opponents of the mullahs were being led out onto rooftops or to gallows and executed on a daily basis. So if someone threatens you, you're an American, you're accused of being a spy, you're going to be executed, you believe it. And believe me, these hostages had tremendous fears that they had they were making their last stand. It was fascinating for me, and I just think it fascinates me as a human being, how people cope with a situation like that. And each of the 52 hostages had their own way of handling what was going on. Several of them tried to commit suicide, including Tom Ahern, who was the CIA station chief, who was probably the worst treated of all the hostages. He tried to rig up a wire and a battery and an iron or ironing board or something in his room where he thought he might be able to electrocute himself, which he hoped to do because he had this terror of being executed and being filmed while being executed and having his family see these pictures. He was determined to try and kill himself before that happened. Some of the other hostages actually did try to kill themselves. A few of my favorite, though, of the hostages, you know, had their own ways of dealing with this. One of them is Catherine Kuhb, who was one of the two women who was held for the whole time. Most of the women who were taken hostage initially were released. about 2 weeks after the embassy was taken, as a gesture of Islamist courtesy toward females, and also in part because of the belief that women couldn't have held any really important jobs at the embassy. And the two women who were held the whole time were there for specific reasons. One was Anne Swift, who was the political secretary. She was the chief of the political division in the embassy. And on the day of captivity, they rounded up a lot of the women, most of whom were clerics, were clerical secretaries, and were going around the room trying to determine who they were. And she was, Anne Swift was identified with the others as a secretary, and she promptly pointed out that she was not a secretary, which earned her a year in Tehran, words that she lived to regret. Catherine was held because she was the head of the Iran-America Cultural Society, which was a cultural exchange program run by the United States. They had their own campus in Tehran, and she had her own staff in her own building. And she was this middle-aged American woman in charge of this big facility that, in real life, was actually responsible for arranging for cultural exchange, for bringing artists from Iran to touring them in the United States and bringing performers, American performers and artists to Iran. Nevertheless, she was accused of being a spy, and because she had such an important job, she had to be an important spy. So she endured a lot of interrogation. And, as I said, this constant fear of being executed. And so Catherine, who's a very religious woman, basically began thinking of her ordeal as though she were a nun in a convent where you live a very strict religious life. And she structured her days with prayer routines in the morning and afternoon and evening, which gave her a sense of accomplishment, a spiritual progress of, you know, and she's a believer, so she believes her prayers will benefit her family and her friends and her country and her colleagues. And so she diligently applied herself to these religious exercises throughout her months in captivity. I thought that was a very creative and effective way of coping with a difficult situation. Another way of dealing with it was an army sergeant, a cleric at the embassy named Joe Subic. And Joe, his tactic for survival was to cooperate fully with his Iranian captors from the day they were taken. So for instance, on the first day, when they'd captured all these Americans and had no idea who they all were, they had them tied to chairs. And they were interested, obviously, in finding out who were the most important among the people they had taken. Obviously, the Americans were not terribly eager to advertise their position at the embassy, particularly because they felt that this was an event that would probably last a day or two, and so best that they not, you know, have any idea who they had. So they were getting answers. The Iranians were getting answers to the questions, who are you and what do you do? Like, you know, well, my name is Roy Rogers, and, you know, my job is I deliver pizza, or, you know, I do the laundry around here. Well, Joe solved that problem for his captors by taking them around and introducing all of his colleagues to them. This is Colonel Chuck Scott. He's the military liaison. And by the way, he speaks fluent Farsi. This is Michael Matrinko. He's the second political officer here. And you can imagine how his colleagues felt about him. They wanted to strangle him. Joe got special treatment for his cooperation. And if those of you who remember the Christmas propaganda displays that they put on, Joe helped his captors set up the Christmas party. He created a Christmas card for the Ayatollah, supposedly from the hostages, you know, to the Ayatollah. He read a propaganda statement for television. He basically sold out in every way that he could. And when the hostages were returned home, a lot of his military colleagues wanted Joe court-martialed. But in the general flood of good feeling toward the returned hostages, no one ever took action against Joe, except that when Ronald Reagan invited the hostages back to the White House and awarded them civilian honors for the civilians and military decorations for the military people, Joe was not invited. And interestingly, no one noticed. If you look back at all the news coverage, no one pointed out that for some reason this one hostage did not get invited to the White House. We found Joe years later. He is a police chief down in Florida of a small community, and he actually was serving in Iraq as a National Guardsman. So we interviewed him in Iraq for this story. So I cut him a break just because of that, you know. But nevertheless, it's one other way of coping with captivity. My favorite, though, of the hostages was a fellow named Michael Matrinko, who was one of the political officers at the embassy. And Michael is the kind of guy, maybe you've met people like this, who when they travel to a foreign country, they just sort of blend. Within a few weeks, like, they're speaking the language, they're dressing the way the natives dress, they're eating the native foods. I mean, this is Michael. And he had gone to Iran initially some years before this as a Peace Corps volunteer and had learned to speak Farsi fluently and fell in love with the culture and the history and the country of Iran. And then, because he is a political scientist, basically, was absolutely thrilled to be in the embassy during this revolution. To him, it was like, as he put it, being a geologist camped on the rim of an active volcano. This is a guy who doesn't like to come to work in the morning, but goes out at night. He loves to eat and drink and smoke and talk and listen. And he would spend his nights, sometimes until very early in the morning, with Iranian friends, soaking up everything he could learn about what was going on in that country, and then writing his reports back to Washington, which promptly got buried in a bottom drawer somewhere. But he was loving it. He was loving his work. So suddenly these young students come in and tie him to a chair and ultimately lock him in a closet. And Michael was pissed. He was angry because he had things to do that day he was really looking forward to, you know? He never stopped being angry. He fought his captors every single day of captivity. He used his knowledge of their language and their culture to insult them and degrade them and to show them up. And for his efforts, was beaten frequently, was terribly mistreated. In fact, when I went back to Iran and found the many of the hostage takers, I would ask them always, which of the Americans do they remember? And they all remembered Matrinko. You know, as Masumeh Ebtekar, the nasty little spokesperson for the hostages, who's, when I interviewed her, was one of the vice presidents of Iran, said he hated and was hated in return. When Michael, for instance, refused to go to the Christmas pageant that they held because he knew it was just a propaganda display, you know, you have to understand that these Iranian students thought that they were God's messengers on earth and that they were, everything they did was perfectly justified. And they were so full of piety and arrogance, basically, cultural arrogance, that they, when they would make a gesture like for Michael Matrinko, this most hated of the hostages, even though he refused to go to the Christmas pageant, some of his guards made a plate of treats for him and brought it to him just to, as a demonstration of their goodwill. And so Michael takes their gift and marches down the hall to what he called the Khomeini hole, which was his toilet, and dumped the contents right, ceremoniously in front of his friends right into the toilet. So he fought them every day, including up to the last day when the hostages were put on buses and taken to the airport to be flown home. Michael picked a guard, picked a fight with one of the guards on the bus and was thrown off the bus and beaten by the side of the road. And he told me at that point, as the bus pulled away, he started thinking that maybe his strategy was not the best. But they had agreed to release all the hostages, and so they put Michael in a car and drove him to the airport, and much to the relief of himself and his colleagues, a little bit bruised and scraped, he was put on the plane for the flight home. And this is the first time that anyone's told the story of Michael Matrinko, because unlike many of his colleagues who became essentially professional former hostages, Michael was never interviewed about any of this. In fact, you know, those of you who are old enough will remember that the hostages were flown to Wiesbaden after they were released, and there was, of course, no person undergoes an ordeal in American society anymore without mandatory counseling afterwards. So there were counselors there to help the hostages, and of course, hordes of press and dignitaries, you know, waiting to meet with them. And so Michael arrives, and he has friends in Germany, And he's thrilled to no longer be a hostage. So he wants to leave. He tells them, you know, he's heading out. He's got friends are going to go driving, drinking, and eating up and down the Rhine. And they tell him, well, no, you can't leave. You know, you have to go through all this counseling, and everyone wants to meet you and interview. And so he said, am I a hostage? And everybody reeled with horror and said, no, of course not. So he left. And you will never see Michael Matrinco in the pictures of the returning hostages. He just went back about his life and his career. And in fact, the last time I heard from Michael was about 6 months ago. He's living in a tent in Afghanistan. He is currently a contract employee with the State Department, and I think he's serving as a liaison with the Afghan Parliament and the United States. So this is a man who I think is a real hero, a remarkable human being, who is continuing to work, do this wonderful work for the government and utilize all of his skills and talents. So I was thrilled to have the chance to meet Michael and finally tell his story. So as you see, this is a complicated story. Those are my three layers. I actually wrote them each separately, which is the first time I've ever done that with a book, and blended them all together. And I think that this book is the most ambitious effort, at least, to capture this episode, which, as I said, I think is we can see now was really one of the pivotal moments in modern history. I'll tell you one more thing, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions. The kind of work that I do, what makes it so much fun, in part, is that you are always surprised by what you find. The world is never as you expect to find it. People are never completely as you expect them to be. And you have to constantly be open, I think, to how different the world is than what you imagine it to be. And a very minor example of this came when I was in Tehran on my last trip there. The Discovery Times channel, which has made a companion documentary for this book, sent a still photographer over to take promotional pictures of me. So the photographer was posing me on a busy sidewalk in Tehran in front of a wall-sized mural of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who was sort of benevolently gazing down over my shoulder. And as I stood there, an Iranian walking by on the sidewalk says, "What do you want a picture of that asshole for?" And I just assumed he wasn't talking about me. Thank you.
To move to the back of the room, and I'd ask those who have questions to meet me in the back of the room so that questions can be posed to Mark Bowden. While I'm moving to the back of the room, Mark, I wonder if you would comment and sort of extrapolate from the recent interviews you've done of bad guys kind of all over the world, and tell us what you think the next two or three years holds for us in terms of attacks on Americans and American properties?
It's a big question. My feeling is that very understandably, we as a country, in a way, overestimated the threat of terrorism after the 9/11 attacks, which is not to say that it's not very real. But 9/11 succeeded way beyond the expectations of even the people who carried out that attack. And as we've seen in the years since, their capability of doing something on that level is very limited. What they are capable of, these terrorist cells all over the world, are occasional horrible acts of mass murder. And if they ever get their hands on a serious weapon, it could be a serious blow to Western society. And so I don't minimize the importance of the war on terror, but I do try to convince, for instance, my wife that the market in Oxford, Pennsylvania is probably safe from terrorist attack on a day-to-day basis. And that we do need to, I think, understand that the Al-Qaeda is not a terribly well-organized, centrally governed organization. It is a combination of sort of loose federation of franchises, and often the people creating these cells around the world are extraordinarily incompetent and thuggish. The story about Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines was an eye-opener for me. I mean, these supposed Islamist leaders were basically rapists and murderers and kidnappers and thugs who were using the cloak of Islamist fundamentalism to rationalize and justify what it was they did. So to a certain extent, the more we talk about, you know, the threat of Islamic militantism and the threat of organizations like Al-Qaeda, we run the risk of glorifying them to the point where we make them more powerful than in fact they are. And you know, wannabes around the world identify with this organization which so threatens the United States of America. When I was traveling around promoting this book, I went to like 30 different American cities, and I remember one night pulling into Seattle, getting off a plane and driving into Seattle, which is a magnificent city, enormous, and it was all lit up. And what is a city except it's an expression of the wealth and power of a society? And that city, I thought, you know, this city of Seattle, which is just stunning, would be the crowning jewel of 99% of the countries in the world if they had Seattle. You know, that would be the biggest thing in that country and the most important thing. And Seattle was just one of dozens and dozens and dozens of cities like that in the United States. So the idea that somebody could blow themselves up in a mall in somewhere in the Middle West, which is a perfectly horrible thing, the idea that that somehow is going to bring the United States of America to its knees, is going to threaten our way of life, is, I think, a vastly exaggerated notion. We are much, much stronger than that, and our power and our wealth run much deeper than I think most of us can even imagine.
I was wondering, did you interview any of the other Americans that were basically hostages there? I had family there. My sister was married to an Iranian, living there in February when the revolution started. Basically, any Americans that were just living there were told they could leave within 24 hours or they would be on a machine gun guard. Mm-hmm. She was newly pregnant, and so she chose not to leave. They were there. The hospital where my niece was born, 6 days after the hostages were taken, was blown up because there were Americans in that hospital. That story hasn't really been told, and I don't know whether you've interviewed any of the hundreds of Americans that were there basically as hostages. She escaped through Turkey, by the way, and they hijacked trucks to do it.
In March of 80. So. Yeah, I did run into a lot of people, and you're right. I mean, there are so many fascinating stories in and around that period because the United States was so integrally linked with Iran for a quarter of a century, and then abruptly, that link was severed, and so there were many Americans who were caught in the switches. The story of Ross Perot rescuing his workers is a piece of this story of the revolution. I also met many Iranians who live in the United States today who fled after the revolution, who have equally hair-raising and fascinating stories. But as I hope I've gotten across, this just the story of the embassy was such a complex undertaking that you do your best not to get pulled in too many directions.
Quick military question back to 1979 and the Delta Force. At that point, did the Israelis have a lot more commando capability than we did, and did we access that, or were we too proud?
They did have a lot better capability than we had. In fact, the rescue at Entebbe was one of the impetuses for the creation of Delta Force. In fact, Carter at that point asked his military advisors, do we have that capability? And they said, no, we don't. So, you know, they set about to create it. As far as the mission itself, Israel, to my knowledge, was not consulted on it. Charlie Beckwith was extremely concerned about the security of this operation. And the German government, I know, offered to help because the Iranians were allowing German camera crews to enter the embassy grounds and interview people. And so the German military offered to send some of their special operators in disguised as TV people to do some intelligence work, basically, to spy on the inside of the embassy. And Beckwith refused to work with them because he was terrified that word would leak of this mission.
Taking into account your limited knowledge, as you expressed at the beginning, what exactly was the American embassy up to prior to the taking of the hostages? Were they trying to turn the revolution in their favor or maintain contact? What was going on there?
Nothing was going on, in answer to your question. It was one of the questions that I really wanted to answer, and I actually spent a lot of time wading through the piles and piles and piles of documents that were seized at the embassy, the spy den documents, which Iran has painstakingly published. And, you know, they actually went to the trouble of piecing back together shredded documents and published all of them. And it's not worth it. I mean, there's a very good sort of history of America's involvement in Iran in those papers, but nothing that justifies the claim that the United States was trying to overthrow the revolution. In fact, the opposite is the case. The United States had accepted the revolution. The reason we kept an embassy in Tehran during those tumultuous months was because we felt it was very important to try to establish a relationship with this new government, whatever it was going to be, for geopolitical reasons. Iran was a linchpin of America's strategy for defending the Middle East against possible Soviet incursion. So we were determined to live with this new regime to a fault. And the CIA operation was pathetic. But the funny thing about the Iranian students is that their idea of spying came from James Bond movies. So they were doing things like all the Americans they took hostage, they were examining their belts and their shoes and in their watches. And they were always convinced that they were secretly communicating back to Washington, when in fact, there were four CIA officers in the embassy. Tom Ahern was the station chief. He'd been there the longest at, what, four months? Bill Daugherty was one of the CIA officers who was taken hostage, had entered the CIA in a crash program in 1979, where he signed up in January, and they had him in the field 6 months later. And so within like 2 or 3 weeks of being sent to Iran, he was taken hostage. The guy would be the first to tell you that he didn't have a clue what was going on in that country. None of them spoke Farsi. Even if they had wanted to be up to no good, they weren't in any position to do anything. And so, you know, all of these Iranian suspicions were unfounded. And, you know, I think all of it's pretty well documented, too.
Two quick questions. One, did any of the hostages refuse to talk with you for any reason? And two, you have another book project in the works right now.
Several of the former hostages who have consistently refused to talk would not talk to me as well, and they have all since been in contact with me regretting the fact that they didn't cooperate and wanting to be interviewed after the book is done, which was kind of a useless exercise for me. One of them, Court Barnes, was one of the CIA communicators, and I always feel I respect anybody's decision about whether they want to talk about their experiences or not, but he had refused to be interviewed, and I made a point toward the end of this project of asking Terrence, my assistant, to make sure that we had written letters to all of the three or four hostages who had refused to be interviewed, so that, you know, I didn't want to be accused later on of not having tried to talk to them, right? So I asked Terrence to do that. We got an email from Court Barnes after the book came out, indignant that we had not interviewed him for the project. And so I went to Terrence and I said, we contacted him, didn't we? And he says, oh yeah, we did. So did you ever send him a letter? And he said, yeah, and he responded. And so we had Court's very pointed response saying, leave me alone, I do not want to be interviewed for this story, which I then emailed to him, and he kind of sheepishly acknowledged that he had missed the opportunity. So yeah, there were a few holdouts. Next projects, I'm writing a screenplay at the moment. More and more of my career is taken up with Hollywood stuff, which is fun. I work for The Atlantic. I have the cover story, as you see, in the recent issue, and then another cover will be out the month after next, which is about the intelligence operation that caught Zarqawi in Iraq, which is a fascinating look at how we have developed a capability in the last 5 or 6 years of working and penetrating terrorist organizations. It's a fascinating story, and it's about these young people who have become professional interrogators, basically, who have now, you know, 5 or 6 years of experience in Afghanistan and Iraq, and who are an elite cadre, basically, of skilled interrogators. And when you read how they worked this one detainee with no torture, not even any coercion, but how they got this one detainee to effectively tell them where Zarqawi was, it's just an amazing story. I'm also working on a book about the 1958 NFL championship game between the Colts and the Giants, which I'm really enjoying working on. So those are my projects at the moment.
Mark, you had indicated that there was a positive outcome, even though the military exercise was not successful because of the development of the Delta Force. Is there a comparable positive outcome that we learned governmentally as a result of the experience there in Iran?
I'm not sure that there was. I think, you know, the lesson that I would take from this episode is the need to become more aware of what is happening within countries that are important to us for one reason or another. To me, the most shocking aspect of this whole thing was that we failed to foresee the Iranian revolution. In fact, Carter was getting intelligence estimates months before the revolution that told him not only was Iran not about to have a revolution, it was not even, as the document says, in a pre-revolutionary state. So I mean, we totally missed the board. I see the work that people like Michael Matrinko was doing in Iran as invaluable. I mean, he was doing that for the State Department, but I think more and more, you know, that's the kind of work that our intelligence agencies should be doing so that we have people in position around the world with an understanding of the internal politics of the countries that we're interested in, with an understanding of the culture and the language, so that if we need to act there, we aren't just blundering in, you know, with a bunch of kids from Fort Benning who can't even find the place on a map where they're being sent. So I think we have to get smarter about that. And I think, you know, one of the lessons that we might have learned from this episode was to get smarter like that. But in fact, I don't think we did. I think we are now, though. I think that's one of the things that is a more of a consequence of 9/11 than the Iran hostage crisis.
This is almost a sidebar question, but I'm curious. When the new fellow came into power there in Iran, President Tom, what's his name, there was speculation that he had been one of the hostage takers, one of the leaders of that group. Mm-hmm. Were you able to look into that or confirm that at all?
Yes, and he was. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was one of the five students who organized the takeover of the American embassy. And he was initially opposed to it because he and another one of these five wanted to take over the Soviet embassy, not the American embassy, because they perceived the Soviet Union as the greater threat to their revolution. But he has said himself that as soon as the Ayatollah Khomeini endorsed the takeover of the embassy, he supported it. And that happened the day the embassy was taken. So a number of the hostages remember or claim they remember being interrogated by Ahmadinejad. I don't know if that's true or not. It might be. But it's been 25 years. I don't base my knowledge of his actions on their memories. I was in Iran on three separate trips looking for the people who took over the embassy, and the question I asked everyone was, who were the ringleaders? Who are the people I need to talk to? And everyone included him as part of the governing council of students. He was at the time mayor of Tehran when I was working on this, and virtually unknown to the rest of the world, and refused to be interviewed about it even then. So his posture that he was not involved, I think is he takes it for political reasons in his country. Interestingly, being a former hostage taker is no longer a big political advantage in Iran. Because particularly Ahmadinejad's right-wing conservative groups, they view the takeover of the American embassy, you're going to laugh, but they do, as a CIA event. The CIA engineered the takeover of our own embassy. And they believe this because the takeover of the American embassy has led to just an unparalleled series of catastrophes for their country over the past 25 years, beginning with Saddam Hussein's invasion of Iran, which took place while they were still holding American hostages, and which ultimately led to wiping out virtually an entire generation of young Iranians. So as I had it explained to me on numerous occasions, anything that was that harmful to Iran had to have been planned by their worst enemies. So you can see why Ahmadinejad is not terribly eager to own up to it at this point.
Let me ask everyone if they would remain in their seats so that Mark Bowden can make it out to the other room to sign copies of his books. I want to make certain that everyone in the room knows my colleague, our distinguished scholar in residence, Bill Miller, whose friendship with Mark Bowden resulted in his accepting our invitation. And let us thank Mark Bowden.